me from some unfortunate accident. Whatever happens, I shall go on with my work, and hope people will understand that the past is the past, and has nothing to do with the work I've done since. The one thing I can thank these bastards for is that I've had a chance to show you it's possible to make a difference. You do what you want to do, Keith. I don't want to drag you any farther into all this. I appreciate your being paid well, and I'm sure you could use the money. I'll hold no grudges if you decide to go ahead. I'm used to being misunderstood. It's a badge of honor. Regards, Hamish. Almost an hour later, Scylla arrived in a cab. She still had her cough and blamed the heavy schedule of the Madrid Book Week for impeding her recovery. They didn't talk much about the book. She could tell Mabbott wasn't happy with the situation, but at the same time she said she was pleased and relieved that he'd done what he had to do. He'd even put the manuscript in a nice red folder.
"Thanks, dear boy. I'll call you in the morning."
Mabbott picked up the folder. "I'll come with you. Deliver it personally."
"If you're sure you want to do that. Ron'll appreciate it."
At around 7:30, they drew up outside Latham's glittering apartment block beside the river in Battersea. Scylla paid the fare and they walked towards the lobby. Automatic doors slid aside to admit them. Mabbott looked around.
"I thought he lived in the office."
Scylla laughed.
"He takes Sunday evenings off."
She announced their names to a bored security guard, who queried the name twice before buzzing Latham's apartment. Once inside the lift, Scylla pressed the button for the 20th floor, and with a breathy hiss they were swept upwards and disgorged into a silent, carpeted, climate-controlled corridor. Ron opened the door, raising his eyebrows when he saw the two of them. He was wearing a white toweling robe, and his face was bright pink.
"Keith, what a nice surprise."
He stood back to let them in.
"I hadn't expected the author himself."
Mabbott caught the quick exchange of glances with Scylla. He stepped into the room. It was what he'd expected. Modern furniture, a lot of appliances, speakers, screens, things in aluminium, framed certificates on the wall. More surprisingly, a lot of books on wall-to-ceiling shelves, some novels among them.
"Drink?" asked Latham. "I've been breaking my back down in the gym, so I'm on ice water. Scylla?"
She chose a juice, a Mabbott a beer, and Latham went to fetch them from the kitchen.
"That's a view," said Scylla, walking across to the window.
The size and height of the plate glass made Mabbott feel slightly queasy. A Lufthansa Airbus, sinking towards Heathrow with a mournful wail, passed across their line of vision like something from a computer game. She made a face.
"I can never get used to it."
Mabbott just had time to pick up on the remark when Latham appeared with the drinks on a tray.
"Heineken, all right?"
That's fine, thanks." They sat down on either side of a low glass-topped table, Mabbott and Scylla together, Latham opposite. He raised his glass.
"So, bang on time. Cheers, and thanks all round."
Latham smiled magnanimously at Mabbott.
"I know it wasn't easy for you, and I apologize about the pressure, but I appreciate what you've done, Keith. I think it's something we'll all be proud of."
Latham pulled his robe tighter around him and eyed the red binder.
"So, do I get to have a look?"
He and Scylla laughed, and he reached forward. As he did so, Mabbott put his hand on the manuscript.
"I just wanted to say a few thanks of my own, Ron, if I may, now that the book's finished."
Ron nodded.
"That's nice."
For some reason, Mabbott noted the time on the digital clock on the sideboard. It was 19:38. Another airliner, lights flashing, cruised across the window. Mabbott raised his glass.
"Ron, Scylla, I want to thank you both for giving me the chance to do this book. I also want to thank Carl Hattaker and the Hattaker family for enabling the Hemisphere Grain Group to continue their good work in clearing the rainforests of the world, and for generously donating some of the profits to fund the activities of Wide Hat Publishing, without whom there will be no urgent books. I should like to thank you, Ron, as my publisher, for encouraging me to look at all aspects of the life of a previously honourable man, and to you, Scylla, for standing by me when I wavered." and to Hamish Melville, wherever he is, I say thank you for all you have done to open my eyes and the eyes of the world to what is really going on. No one moved. Hamish, I hope I've kept my side of the bargain. He drank deeply, set the glass down on the mirrored table, and only then did he take his hand off the folder and push it across the table. Goodbye, Ron. Bye, Scylla. Thanks for the drink. Enjoy the book. And with that, Mabbott stood, collected his coat, and left. Scylla sat staring at the door as if she was expecting it to be opened again, and the whole scene rerun to a different script. But it remained closed. Latham pulled the file towards him. He loosened the elastic at either corner and drew out the manuscript. Well, at least I don't have to be nice to him any longer. Scylla flashed him a look of irritation. Come on, Ron. He gave you what you wanted in the end. She paused. Ron? Latham was staring down at the title page, his face immobile. His left hand beat hard and fast on the top of the table. What's the matter? Latham said nothing, but shot the manuscript across the table towards her. Take a look. Scylla gasped. She ruffled through the first few pages, as if they might offer some explanation, but they only confirmed her worst fears. There it was on the title page, in 16-point, bold Times New Roman. Triumph in Adversity, the official history of the Solemn Vow Oil Terminal. Chapter 10. The terminal came into sight as Mabbott drove down the immaculate road that ran alongside the company's airstrip. A private jet was loading up, and a line of stooped figures in high-visibility jackets, heads down into the wind, were hurrying towards the aircraft steps. High in the sky, white clouds were dashing across from the west. A moment later, the dark waters of the Vow appeared to his left. With a twinge of nostalgia, he glimpsed the four familiar piers jutting out from the terminal complex. A Norwegian-registered crude carrier, the Olaf Kona of Bergen, was offloading oil from one of the newly opened deep-water fields out in the North Atlantic. On higher ground, behind the jetties, stood the rows of crude oil storage tanks, 16 circular drums, each one capable of holding 600,000 barrels. Mabbott once knew this world well. This thousand-acre city, squatting on damp and windswept hills, where not much more than 30 years ago there was nothing but isolated crofts and grazing sheep. Mabbott pulled up at the barrier to the car park. There was a new man on security, someone he'd not seen before. He handed over the permit he'd been given. My name's Mabbott. I'm here to see the head of external relations. The man consulted the list carefully, moving his lips as he read through the names. Have you any means of identification? Apart from the letter with my name on it. The man, whose complexion was so smooth it was almost baby-like, simply nodded. Mabbott dug around in his wallet and handed over his driver's license. A flock of herring gulls wheeled around a garbage truck that was emerging from the service entrance. Once inside the compound, Mabbott cruised the long rows of parked cars until he found a space close to the administration building. He reversed in, as was required by the regulations. To one side loomed the tall walls of the terminal's own power plant, the largest building on Shetland, they proudly used to say, as if that made up for the way it looked. Behind him was a 10-foot security fence topped with coils of razor wire. Behind that, rabbits were playing on the hillside. It had been only a month since he walked away from the book deal, although it seemed more like a year, so profoundly had his life changed. For once, he hadn't looked back, had second thoughts, or sought compromise. Instead, he had stayed at home, cleaned the house, painted the front doorstep, washed down the garden chairs, and enjoyed the summer evenings. He had realized with some surprise that his self-respect and confidence, far from being shattered, were enhanced. There would always be the Scyllas and the Lathams of this world who would tell you what you should do. But however persuasive, understanding, and even generous they might be, they were ultimately acting on their own behalf. He, on the other hand, had been very bad at acting at all. Scylla was right. He had too often been passive, full of thoughts and ideas and opinions, but always waiting for someone else to tell him what to do with them. But through Melville, he had acquired a confidence in his own judgment that he had never known before. He was not a fool. He knew that, true or false, Trickett's evidence was always there, and he could hardly deny that Ursula existed. But from the moment Latham and Urgent decided that these should be key ingredients in a book about an inspirational environmentalist, he knew where they were going. And he knew that he must not accompany them. It was now up to him to make sure that the story Urgent wanted to tell would never see the light of day. In the days that followed his last meeting, he had consolidated this position. Not only had he refused to do Ron Latham's rewrites, he had threatened that if anyone else did, he would produce a full account of Ron's part in the whole affair. Lawyers locked horns, threats were made, dust was raised, but within a couple of weeks, the deadline for meeting a Christmas publication schedule passed, and by the end of the month, Mabbutt was able to share with Wendy Lou the good news that Urgent had quietly put the book to one side. Christina had been predictably unforgiving about his decision to abandon a small fortune, but he no longer felt vulnerable to her taunts. Nor was the money as important or necessary. Rex, that decent man, had stepped in to bankroll the family while demanding nothing back, apart from Christina. So here he was, back on the island where the news that Christina wanted to finalise their separation had first hit him like a sledgehammer. Now, with hindsight, he was able to accept that if it had not been for his stubborn refusal to let Christina go, much unhappiness would have been avoided. Last week, with the approval of all the family, he had agreed not to contest the divorce. Almost exactly on the dot of 1 o'clock, he saw May Lennox leave the building. He opened the door and waved. She grinned, waved back, and made her way to the car. He leaned over to kiss her. She offered both cheeks, formally, as if they were still at work.
"You're cold," she said.
"I've had the window open. I thought we could go to that new place in Bray," he said as he drove towards the gate. May seemed breathless, as if she'd run from somewhere.
"That'd be nice. I mustn't be longer than the hour, though. There's a bit of a crisis on."
"Oh?"
"There have been gales all week out in the Atlantic, and one of the loading tankers hit the rig. Could have been a whole lot worse, but they've closed the operation, which of course makes everyone a wee bit twitchy."
As they turned onto the road towards Bray, Mabbutt was aware of May fiddling with her clothing, opening her coat, adjusting a scarf, tugging at her tight grey jacket.
"Well, hey, what a surprise."
Mabbutt laughed. "I told you I'd come up, didn't I?"
"Have you brought your new book?"
His face clouded. "No, it didn't exactly work out."
"I was looking forward to that, Keith."
"So was I, but it wasn't meant to be."
"I'm sorry about that. You must be gutted."
A sharp squall blew in from nowhere. Mabbutt flicked on the wipers as the rain spat against the windscreen. "Oh, no. It was all for the best, I promise you." Sammy's fish bar had a well-scrubbed white wood feel to it. There was a takeaway section that was busier than the tables, so they found themselves sitting beside a big picture window with room to spare. Over fish and chips, Mabbutt told May the whole story, about the book and how he'd walked away from it, and about Christina and the divorce. She looked at him with a concern that he tried to brush off.
"I feel so much better, May. I've started to make decisions rather than avoiding them. I won't have a wife for much longer, and I won't have an agent either, nor a publisher. But what I hadn't expected is that what appeared to be the worst thing that could happen to me would turn out to be the best."
He took a sip of beer. May raised her eyebrows and nodded in agreement.
"So why did you decide to come all the way up here?"
Mabbutt smiled. He stared out of the window, scanning the dark bays and the low, close-cropped hills running down to the sea. Then he turned back to May. "There are times in your life when you're so busy doing a job, you don't see what's going on around you. When I was up here trying to get my head round prefabrication policies and oil flow anomalies, I just took it all for granted. This was my workplace, like any workplace anywhere. But I've not been able to get it out of my mind, May. Not just the islands and the peace and the beauty of the place, but the people too. What I sometimes mistook for them being closed up and defensive
was just a different way of looking at the world. When people didn't talk much, I thought they were trying to tell me something. I like that. Now I realise that they don't talk unless they've something to say. There's a constancy to people here. It reminds me of what I saw in the hills in India, among the tribes there. Constancy is something very precious. May looked towards the door, so Mabbott called for the bill. I also realise how much I took your help and friendship for granted. I don't think I ever stopped to think how close we've become. You have a fundamental honesty that is so incredibly rare, and it chimes with everything I've learnt from working with Melville. It's not pious or pompous. It's just a straightforward truthfulness that I know is right and good. If I decide to go and work with Melville, would you ever, just possibly, consider coming with me? They were both silent for a moment. Then May slipped a glance at her watch.
Keith, I have to go. You've all your plans and it sounds so exciting.
But for me, reality is a damage limitation meeting at 3 o'clock. You've the chance to do something good in the world. I have to look at the implications of a company losing over £1 million a day if we shut down the rig. She got to her feet. Keith hurriedly stood up too. Think about it. That's all I ask. You don't have to decide now. There was not much more to say as they drove back, and as soon as they reached the terminal gate, May pushed the door open and ran off towards the admin block.
Tonight, he shouted after her. 8 o'clock. I'm at the Stratzer House.
She nodded briefly, then pushed through the security turnstile and was gone. He stood in front of the mirror. A blade of evening sunshine cut between the houses and caught the side of his face, reminding him that he was now in the latter half of his lifespan. His skin, always taut and trim, seemed paler than usual. He ran his fingers along his jaw, wondering whether he should shave before meeting May. Earlier, after leaving her at the terminal, he checked into the hotel, and as the wind dropped and the clouds cleared, he walked into the centre of Lerwick. He'd sat on the Victoria Pier and watched the comings and goings of small boats and the unhurried approach of the ferry from Bressay, revelling in the smell of salt and tar and the cries of fat gulls quarrelling over territory. He could easily just stay here, he thought. Buy an old crofter's cottage, do it up, move in with May. He could write, she could commute to the terminal. They could run a B&B, take in guests. Maybe buy a small boat like the ones moored up at the pierside, waiting to take tourists to see the puffins or the colonies of gannets. The blast of a ship's horn had broken his reverie. An offshore maintenance vessel cast off and moved slowly away from the pier heading south. At 7:30, Mabbott walked into the bar that occupied one end of the Clickerman suite to find May already there. She wasn't alone. Kevin O'Connolly rose to his feet, smiling broadly and extending one of his big red hands.
"Keith, whatever brought you back to this blighted land?"
Keith was about to kiss May, but something in her body language held him back.
"I came to see May."
"So I hear. Took her to Sam's for a gourmet lunch. What are you drinking?"
"A glass of white wine, please."
O'Connolly waved his arm airily.
"I'll get a bottle. We can drink it with the meal."
While he went to the bar, Keith sat down and gave May a puzzled look. "What's he doing here?" She didn't have time to reply before O'Connolly returned from the bar. He was grinning broadly, like the cat that had eaten the cream, thought Keith.
"I've made it champagne," he said, squeezing in beside May, "in celebration of your return to Ultima Thule."
Keith forced the smile that O'Connolly clearly expected. He tried to catch May's eye for some sort of explanation, but she was studiously looking away. Then O'Connolly put his hand on hers and grinned at Keith, almost bashfully.
"And our wee bit of good news, too."
Finally, May did look up, and when her eyes met Keith's, he felt as if he had been pushed off a cliff. O'Connolly squeezed May's hand.
"Are you going to tell him or am I?"
Ironically, the meal that followed was saved from total disaster by the thing Mabbutt least liked about Kevin O'Connolly, his total absorption in himself. There was simply no time to get onto any bruising personal ground, as Kevin relentlessly revisited his childhood. The absent, drunken father, the tough streets, the pride of the men at the Clydebank shipyards, and the bitterness as their industry shrank to almost nothing. They were the kind of Gorbel's boy-makes-good stories he'd heard many times before, but Mabbutt was grateful for them now, a constant, almost soothing background music to his torment. The next morning, as if in sympathy with his mood, the islands were shrouded in fog. No flights were coming in and out of Sumbra until the afternoon, so Mabbutt had time to walk into town. The mist turned everything Dickensian, and his footsteps sounded unnaturally loud on the damp flagstones of Commercial Street. Mabbutt bought a half-dozen bottles of wine at some horrendous price, and left them at the hotel reception with a note and a card for May and O'Connolly, wishing them a happy married life. He called May's number at the terminal, but she wasn't answering. He left a message, and after an early lunch took the winding road to the airport for what he knew would be the last time. Chapter 11. A month had passed since Mabbutt had told Wendy Lou the good news about the book, and it was over a week since he'd emailed offering his services, if Melville had indeed been serious about his invitation. He had hoped to have heard something, even an acknowledgement. Whenever he rang, Wendy had apologized. Melville was doing something very hush-hush. As soon as it was over, he would be in touch. With Christina, May, and Melville receding into the distance, life was simple again. Not perfect, but simple. The mist had parted, and the future was clear. As he restored his Albana books and papers to the desk and the shelves, and repinned his maps and time charts to the wall, his gaze lingered over a photo of Melville. On anyone else, the craggy features, the high cheekbones, and the wild hair would look merely old, perhaps a little sad, a portrait of a life running out. But even on this small and curling photograph, the big, deep-set eyes carried such life and strength that it was difficult to tear oneself away. Mabbutt looked at the image fondly and pinned it to the top corner of his board. What was it he'd said to May about constancy? This was the face of constancy. Even if he were never to see this face again, it would be the one part of his old life to remain here, as he finally settled down to write Albana. So deeply had he immersed himself in the plains of Ewa and the escape of Stion and Eris from the rivers of fire, that at first he failed to hear the doorbell. When it went again, it was loud and long enough to jolt him from his reverie, and Stanley from a deep sleep. It was mid-afternoon in June, and the only other sound he could hear was the distant shouting of children in a nearby playground. Mabbutt ran down the stairs and opened the door. It was a delivery man again, this time quite middle-aged, with dark circles beneath his eyes and what used to be called a Viva Zapata moustache. He held out an envelope. Mabbutt looked at it curiously. The address was handwritten, but not in a hand he recognised. He took it and signed, the delivery man belying his mournful appearance with a broad smile. There was a letter inside, written on thick, expensive notepaper. There was no address on the top, just a single name in red and embossed, Ursula Weitz. Her message was short and to the point. Something important had arisen, and she asked whether Mabbutt would come out to Carla Vivari. She was holding a hotel room for him and had booked him a club-class ticket to Prague. Mabbutt stood there holding the letter. He was confused. Why her? Why now? Just as he had clambered out of that world, he was in danger of being dragged back in, which was absolutely not what he wanted. It was Friday night, quiz night at the Dog and Feathers. He hadn't been there for weeks, and it suddenly seemed the perfect place for a soon-to-be official bachelor. He dropped the letter on the kitchen table, finished his day's work, fed Stanley, and went out. Mabbutt laid down his book and gazed out of the window. The train from Prague was wriggling its way through steep-sided cuttings, thick with pine and birch and alder. It was high summer, and the beams of late afternoon sunlight threw long shadows across the forest floor. He had been booked into the Hotel Victoria, a three-star place on a steep hill called the Stare Mitska. There was a note from Ursula saying that his room and dinner had been paid for, and suggesting they meet at the clinic at 9:30 the next morning. The hotel seemed to have been hijacked by a noisy Russian wedding party, so Mabbott ignored the free meal and walked down into the centre of town. Everywhere was busy, but he found a freshly vacated table outside the Café Elephant, and despite repeated attempts for the waiter to get him inside, he tenaciously clung on to it. For the next couple of hours, he watched the noisy throng of tourists passing by and ordered white wine spritzers to keep the waiter happy. When he returned to the Victoria, the Russian party was in full swing, the lift was broken, and he felt slightly ill. Mabbott collected his key and walked up to room 416. On one of the landings, he passed a couple enmeshed, hands inside each other's clothing. The next morning, he set out for the clinic. A bell was tolling in the Church of Maria Magdalena. Stalls were being set out on the street, and the first groups were already gathering to take the water. He crossed the Tepla River, a thin shadow of when he was last here, and walked along the line of boutiques and gift shops to the Galena Centre. He was buzzed in. It was still early, and cleaners in green overalls were sweeping the stairs. Picking his way round them, he climbed the stairs to the reception area. He pushed open the door and spotted Ursula instantly. She was bent over, her back to him, arranging flowers on a low table. She was not yet in her pristine white uniform, and wore a loose-fitting pink tracksuit. She turned and smiled as he came towards her. She was wearing no makeup, and her face seemed older than he remembered. She shook his hand warmly, thanked him for coming, and, giving instructions to one of her assistants, led him through to her office. "Coffee?" Ursula was clearly in off-duty mode. Indeed, her behaviour as a whole was very different from his last visit. She seemed relaxed, but preoccupied. As the espresso machine went about its work, she reached into a cupboard and took down a packet of Lucky Strikes. "Would you mind, Mr. Mabbott?" "Of course not." She took out a cigarette, lit it gratefully, and flicked a switch. There was a soft hum from above the alcove where she stood. With a wry smile, she pointed upwards. "The rewards of running a health clinic, your own private extractor fan." She poured the coffee, helping herself to two lumps of sugar, before offering the bowl to Mabbott. Then she sat down at her desk. She looked tired. That was it. That was what was different. She looked tired, and she'd made no attempt to disguise it. "Thank you for coming at such short notice. Thank you for making it so easy for me. I'm sorry I couldn't put you in the hotel pub. It's the best one, and you should see it before you go, but last night they were having a big wedding. A Ukrainian. Had the whole place and three orchestras. He's the second richest man in Kiev." She pulled on the cigarette, inhaled as if her life depended on it, then blew the smoke up towards the fan. She took one more pull, then stubbed out the cigarette and dropped it in a bin. She looked hard at him for a moment. "Mr. Mabbott, my father and I are very grateful for what you did."
"For what I did?"
"Yes. For being a man of principle and not letting them bully you over the book. We are both very grateful."
"You've heard from him then, your father?" She nodded.
"Well, that's good to know. I thought you had no contact with him. I've been going through Wendy Lou in Singapore. She's nice."
"You know her too?"
Ursula picked a strand of tobacco from the end of her tongue. "Oh, yes." She stood abruptly and reached again for the packet of cigarettes. "There are a few things you are going to learn today that will surprise you, maybe shock you. First of all, I must apologize for misleading you."
"About what?"
"You asked me if I ever saw my father, and I said no. But that was because I didn't want to give out any information to anybody, for reasons you will soon understand. I am in touch with my father, and have been for a while. He came to me for help."
"What's wrong?"
She looked up towards a small window high on the wall, which provided the only glimpse of the outside world. "I'm telling you this in the strictest confidence.
My father is in trouble.
What kind of trouble?
She tipped the packet and took out a cigarette.
Every fight my father joins, every cause he supports, makes him new enemies.
I can imagine that.
These enemies are now very powerful, and they are trying to destroy him once and for all. They have tried various ways to discredit what he does. We think the book you were paid to write was one of their strategies. But thanks to you, it didn't work. Now they are trying less sophisticated ways of silencing him.
Mabbott took this in. It seemed oddly melodramatic to hear such a thing from Ursula, and this worried him. She raised a cigarette to her lips, but didn't light it.
A week ago, they put a grenade in the cabin where he and his team were working. 3 of his men were killed.
My God. Is he okay?
Ursula laughed, bitterly.
He was unharmed. Dodged the bullet, as usual. But it shook him. Shook him hard. Made him stop and think.
Do you know where he is? I've been trying to contact him.
Ursula glanced at her watch. Then she walked to the door and beckoned to him.
We are about to open. I'll take you somewhere quieter.
He followed her back through reception, by now spotless, tidy and expectant, and out onto the small landing. She pressed the call button for the lift and turned to him, both businesslike and apologetic.
I must get into my uniform. 5th floor. I'll join you later.
The lift went only as far as the 4th floor, from which a short flight of steps led up into the eaves of the building. The decorative scheme was very different up here, cosier and more colourful, with big rugs in the corridors and impressionist prints on the wall. A slim woman in her 30s, with a blonde ponytail, stepped out from what Mabbott could see was a small office. A half-dozen clipboards hung from hooks on the wall. Above a worktop was a bank of monitors.
"Good morning, Mr. Mabbott. My name is Tabitha."
Seeing his quizzical look, she smiled and added,
"Israeli."
She opened an artfully concealed cupboard and produced a flat, plastic-wrapped package.
"You will be in a treatment area, so I would ask you please to wear the protective clothing and to wash and disinfect your hands before entering."
She indicated a line of cubicle doors to her right. Mabbott donned the garments, which included an overall and plastic covers for his feet and head. Tabitha checked him carefully, then led him along a corridor and through a door with a thick rubber seal. Here the carpets and the cosiness ended, the temperature dropped, and the walls were plain white again. She paused at another door and peered in through a small observation window. There was a name beneath it, which Mabbott didn't recognize. Then she pushed open the door, showed him in, and left. The only illumination in the room came from dim halogen lamps above a bed, from which hung a cluster of cables. These were attached to computer screens and monitors arranged on a glass-topped unit. On the bed lay a figure with a thick white dressing around the top of the head and a thickly bandaged right arm from which a red wire protruded. The head turned towards him, catching the light from one of the lamps above.
"Keith?"
The voice was weak, but unmistakable.
"Did I frighten you?"
"Hamish?"
The bandaged head nodded.
"I didn't expect we'd see each other so soon."
"Are you hurt?"
"Oh, could be worse."
He gave a low chuckle, raised a hand and pointed.
"There's a chair over there somewhere. In the corner, I think."
He pressed a button, and the bed slowly raised him into a sitting position. Mabbott found a small metal stool and squatted on it, wanting to stare, but feeling able to take in what he saw only in quick, furtive glances. Melville's biblically long hair was gone, and what he could see of his face was entirely clean-shaven, giving him a look of gaunt asceticism. A black and purple mark spread out from beneath the bandage, and there was a butterfly dressing across the bridge of his nose. Melville attempted a wide, reassuring smile, but it was clearly uncomfortable for him.
"I hope you don't mind coming here. I asked Ursula to organize it for me. One of the few compensations of this unfortunate business has been that I get to spend some time with my daughter."
He indicated the instrument table by the bed.
Do you mind? There should be some water there.
Mabbott found a plastic bottle with a stack of paper cups beside it. He was about to pour some out when Melville raised his hand.
Not yet.
Melville felt beneath his pillow and produced a dark green quart bottle, unmarked.
Scotch in first.
He unscrewed it expertly and tipped a little into the cup.
Now, the water.
As Mabbott poured, Melville gave a rueful grin.
Another advantage of having your daughter on the case.
He took a careful, almost laborious sip.
I asked her to contact you because I felt I owed you some thanks. You did a very difficult thing, walking away from that book, and I wanted to show my appreciation.
The book was a smear job, a million miles from all those things we talked about together. I couldn't have put my name to that. Melville nodded and then caught his breath sharply, as if in sudden pain. Mabbott was alarmed.
Are you all right?
Yes, it passes quickly.
Ursula said you weren't hurt in the attack.
No, I wasn't hurt. But three of my best boys were killed outright.
So why?
His voice trailed off as Melville raised a hand towards him.
Keith, what I'm going to tell you will be difficult for both of us. All I ask is that you hear me out.
Of course.
It's about the book.
Mabbott edged a little closer.
As I said in my letter to you, Victor Trickett was indeed lying. Bettina was a saint.
Mabbott nodded.
I sensed that. I sensed it all along.
Melville took another sip of whiskey, which provoked a short, hard cough. Then he turned his unnerving gaze towards Mabbott.
There were, however, quite a few other things that you missed, Keith.
Mabbott felt that the room had grown perceptibly cooler. He caught the sharp smell of antiseptic.
I'm not sure what you mean.
A brief smile flickered at the corner of Melville's dry lips. When he spoke again, it was softly and quickly and carefully.
For the past 20 years, I have been paid money by a number of international interests, both governments and private companies, to monitor the depth of feeling among local communities in resource-rich areas. My job was to gauge how antagonistic or otherwise these communities might be to resource extraction. I also undertook to facilitate geological and other surveys in their area and to actively encourage and promote the interests of those local people deemed to be sympathetic to exploration and investment. This does not mean that I was oblivious to the welfare of the people I worked with. Quite the opposite. My instincts were always anti-establishment, and I was never happier than in the company of different societies in distant countries. The farther from my own, the better. Nevertheless, there were times when, if you like, I worked for what might appear to be mutually exclusive interests. And there were times when, if I was unable to persuade either side to do the right thing, I pulled out, knowing I was leaving vulnerable people to their fate.
Who were these?
Melville held up his hand and spoke sharply.
Let me finish. Then you can say anything you want. Or simply walk out.
He took a deep breath and went on.
Things were working well until 2 years ago, when I took on a project in South America. I was conceited enough to think that I could work for both sides in the Pacachua Dam project. It was a very big deal. 8,000 kilometers, 50,000 displaced people. I was being paid to get it closed down in favor of another site my people were promoting. Instead, I helped to get clearance, simply because the other side offered me more. I was greedy. Not for the money so much as for the power and the influence. I had begun to think I was invulnerable, that I knew best and that I could play the various interests off at will, winning for some, losing for others. I'd built up a formidable team, always coming out on top because none of these billionaires knew jack shit about the jungle or the mountains or the people who live there. There was no one in the world who could mix grassroots and Wall Street the way we did. And in my defense, what I did, or what I tried to do, was always to support the local people. If you're feeling charitable, you could see me as Robin Hood. Or possibly Che Guevara. If you aren't, I was more like Kurtz in the Heart of Darkness. What I hadn't noticed was just how fast the game was changing. With the Chinese and the Russians coming into the market, the sums that these big corporations are setting aside for exploration is staggering. They have their own armies, lawyers, PR advisors, but also well-trained, highly paid paramilitaries. Over the years, I've become used to receiving death threats, but usually from nothing more than arrows or blowpipes. Now they're hiring professional hitmen, trained by the KGB or Mossad.
He stopped, lay back his head, and moistened his lips.
Among the many apologies I owe you, Keith, is one for thinking for a very short while that you might be one of them. Probably not a hitman, but quite possibly a spy. Hence the less than warm welcome when you turned up in India, flattering me in your suspiciously fulsome way about my international reputation.
He looked over at Mabbott and took in his look of stunned surprise with a hint of a smile.
As it turned out, you were not only not a hired killer, you were a genuinely decent man, who reminded me, uncomfortably, of the ideals I had when I first got into all this. And that's why Kalpra went down the pan, and why I'm here now.
Mabbott was confused. I thought the blockade was a big success.
I was being paid to get the Masira and the Musa and the Gayara so angry at what was being done to them that they'd come out of the forest with pipes and arrows and set about the Astromex drivers. This will create a backlash in favour of the company and the issuing of mining permits all round. The double bluff misfired. There was no violence from the tribals, and they won an international propaganda victory and a government decision to stop the mining. Which is why I had to get out of Bhubaneswar pretty quickly.
And Kinesh and Kumar and the others. Melville's mouth tightened. He shook his head as vigorously as he could.
They were innocent, like you. They saw it all as something good. I was the only one who knew the bigger story. We worked together for years. We were like old friends. Whereas you, appearing out of the bush, as it were, with your innocence and your ideals and your admiration, forced me to think my way back to the basics. You reflected back to me the person I once was. And that's when things began to go belly up. Having an idealist like you in the camp reminded me of how far I'd come from what I once believed in. And that's when I decided to water down the Kalpra blockade. Let it be big, threatening, but non-violent, the way Gandhi would have done it, which is how it turned out. No one got hurt, and the tribals looked good, and Astromex looked bad, and a few weeks later I was attacked with grenades by someone's private army, and lost three of the best workers I've ever had.
There was silence in the room. Mabbott felt a mix of very different emotions. Disbelief, embarrassment, anger, betrayal. He reached out a hand and sought the reassuring cool of the stainless steel trolley beside him. Melville looked exhausted. Yet there were still things that Mabbott needed to know. He cleared his throat.
Why did you decide to help me with the book?
It was a moment before Melville spoke.
Because to start with, before I really bothered to check out who was behind it, I saw your book as an attempt to have one side of my story told before I was blown up or run over. It would be the best side of the story. The story of what motivated me once upon a time, before I started playing power games with the environment. There was a risk, of course. You had a track record as an investigative journalist, so I had to be careful. I couldn't let you get too close. I gave you the names of a few school friends that I'd all but lost touch with, people I once knew who were fond of me. A long time ago.
Something made him laugh.
It was one of life's little ironies that your admirable idealism and the nasties who controlled your man at Urgent Books combined very neatly to kill off the book.
Still chuckling to himself, Melville reached under the pillow, brought out the bottle of scotch, poured another measure and held the cup out to Mabbott.
Would you top me up?
Mabbott poured in some water.
He sat for a while, watching Melville as he raised the glass to his lips. He seemed slow and old, as if all the energy had gone out of him.
"Why are you telling me all this?"
Melville took another sip, and when he turned back to Mabbott, there was something of the old sparkle back in his eyes, some hint of mischief, some final jag of energy.
"Because I want the book to come out."
Mabbott looked aghast, but Melville raised a hand.
"Only this time, I want it to be the truth."
There was a pause.
"The truth?" "Yes."
Mabbott spoke slowly and cautiously.
"You mean the truth, as in what you've just told me?"
"Yes."
"Wouldn't that be a suicide note?"
"Not at all. It would be an interesting cautionary tale. And I trust you enough to know that you would tell it honestly, but charitably too. Everyone, however admirable they appear to be, is simply human, prone to all the imperfections, temptations, and mendacities that go with the territory."
He smiled.
"Environmentalists are particularly prone to self-righteousness, don't you think?"
Mabbott shook his head.
"I couldn't. I just couldn't do it. The world's stock of role models is low enough. It'd be like telling the world Mother Teresa was a hooker. You'd be hounded by every newspaper and broadcaster on the planet."
"Suppose I wasn't around to worry about it."
Mabbott shrugged dismissively.
"The wounds will heal. You're tough. The way you're going, I might well have shuffled off before you."
"I don't think you've quite got the picture, Keith."
"What do you mean?"
Melville gestured to the bandages.
"These wounds are self-inflicted, at considerable cost."
He chuckled.
"Though my daughter, bless her, has given me a special rate."
Once again, Mabbott's incredulity seemed to energize Melville.
"I'm taking evasive action, that's all. I'm getting rid of Hamish Melville before anyone else does."
His playfulness had returned, and his voice seemed lighter, less strained. It was, Mabbott realized, this life force that was driving him to plan his own extinction.
"By the time my daughter and her technicians have finished with me, and as you can see they've already begun their work, there will be no more Hamish Melville. There'll be me, but not a me that anyone will recognize. Don't look so shocked, Keith. Everybody has nips and tucks these days. I'm just having a few more than most."
"You don't need to do this. It's madness."
"I've never done the conventional thing in my life. Despite everything I've told you, I still do value honesty above everything else. If I can't be a good man, I can at least be an honest man. You can tell the world my story, and I won't be around to get in your way. But someone very like me may get to read it one day. A retired Brazilian rubber planter, perhaps, or a Tibetan monk, though my preference is for an ancient Swedish fur trapper."
His laughter was cut short by another grimace of pain. So hard had Mabbott been concentrating on Melville's words that he hadn't heard the soft swish of the door opening. He looked round. It was Ursula. She said nothing, but looked at her father. He seemed calm now, at peace.
"Mr. Mabbott," she said softly, "time to go."
There was a pause. Melville held out his hand to Mabbott.
"I'm sorry I let you down. But don't you let me down, Keith. Promise me that."
Mabbott reached across and grasped the long, thin, surprisingly powerful hand. He felt it tighten as Melville looked up at him. Mabbott stared back into those piercingly, irresistibly clear blue eyes.
"I'll try my best."
Behind him, Mabbott heard Ursula clear her throat. He stood as she pulled the door open for him.
"Might we meet again?"
Melville pulled a last bright smile from somewhere and shook his head emphatically.
"No. Goodbye, Keith."
Neither said much, as Mabbott and Ursula took the lift back down to reception. She offered him coffee, but he could see she was keen to get back to work. They shook hands.
"My father was fond of you."
Mabbott couldn't resist a smile.
"Eventually. He said he wished he'd met you a lot earlier."
"I'm glad we met at all." She picked up a package from the desk.
He told me to give you this. They're transcripts. Something he and I have been working on together. But he asks that you open them only in the event of his death.
He's not really going to die, is he? Ursula nodded.
Around the end of September, if all goes well.
Mabbott walked out into the increasingly busy streets. He sat down at a cafe across the road, choosing a table from which he could still see the white stuccoed front of the clinic. As he raised his eyes to the decorated frames of the dormer windows on the fourth floor, he had to shade them from the sun. Beside him, in a concrete culvert, the Tepler trickled down from the mountains. The bells on the red-hatted horses tinkled as carriages passed by. Mabbott reached for the bulky brown envelope and slipped it into his bag. Chapter 12. 2 months later, Mabbott was in his workroom, wondering whether he should have a second coffee. It was one of those early autumn days that seemed to suit London well. The night had been cool and clear, and there had been a light mist when he'd first sat down to write. He'd established a productive daily routine and was deep in the creation of an attack from the Asterians in the land of volcanoes. His decision to abandon the pseudo-archaic language he'd invented for his characters had proved crucial, and Albana was now moving forwards by leaps and bounds. His daughter, Jay, now much recovered, had a place at Goldsmith's and was living back at Resserton Road. Sam had a small part in the new series of Doctor Who. Christina was still with Rex, but was finding not having to earn a living deeply unsatisfying, and was looking for some new challenge on which to expend her energies. Mabbott had just turned 57, and in all respects, his life had slipped into a remarkably orderly pattern. The phone beside him rang. It was a voice he hadn't heard for months.
Cilla, how are you?
Keith, I'm so sorry.
She sounded strained and far away.
What's the matter? Haven't you heard?
Heard what?
Hamish Melville. It's so dreadful.
Mabbott started. His mouth was so dry that for a moment he couldn't reply.
Haven't you seen the news?
No. He flicked over to the BBC homepage. The story was just breaking.
Apparently it was the steering.
Melville had been involved in an accident. His car had plunged off a coastal road in a remote part of southern Argentina.
He was on his own, apparently. Must have lost control. They're looking for another vehicle that was seen on the same road earlier in the day.
A helicopter had been deployed, but this was the storm season, and the authorities were saying it might be difficult to find the body.
Apparently he was working down there on some land rights issue. I suppose that's the way he would have wanted it.
Mabbott found himself both tense and detached.
Keith? Are you there?
Thanks, Cilla.
I'm sorry, I'm just in shock.
There'll be a memorial, I suppose.
I guess so.
Look, I know it's none of my business, dear boy, but since the book went belly up, how have you been keeping?
Oh, I'm fine. Thanks, Syl.
I get by. She sounded relieved.
Well, see you around, dear boy. I do miss you.
As the news broke, the media tried to do what they could with background on Melville, but there was precious little to go on. What was above and beyond doubt was that a brilliant, if unorthodox, man had paid the price for a life of tireless travel across the world, defending the rights of those whose voices might never have been heard. Shortly after midday, Mabbott returned to the Capital Storage Company in St. John's Wood and removed a strongbox. In it lay the package that Ursula had given him nearly 3 months earlier. He took it back to Resserton Road and opened it at his desk. There were three sealed envelopes inside. Two of them contained microcassette tapes. In the third, a longer envelope, was a letter. The same old Foreign Office heading, smartly struck through with a red pen. Beneath it, in sweeping italic hand, was the message,
"For the book they never published, and the book that lies ahead. Hamish."
Stapled to it was a cheque for £120,000. It had been post-dated to the 19th of September, the day of his death. Hamish Melville's body was never found. He was given a posthumous knighthood by the Queen, and a hall was named after him at the University of Strathclyde. 2 years later, Melville, The True Story of a Legend, became the most successful self-published work of all time. The company that issued it, Slow Books, run by Keith Mabbutt and his ex-wife Christina Naismith, was set up with £120,000 capital from an anonymous investor. Their next book, The First Men, Volume 1 of the Albana Trilogy, was published 3 years later, to universally lukewarm reviews. At the last count, it had sold 8.5 million copies worldwide. You have been listening to an Orion audiobook, The Truth, written by Michael Palin and read by Alex Jennings. The recording was produced and directed by Nicholas Jones at Strathmore Publishing. The executive producer was Pandora White. The text is copyright 2012 by Michael Palin, and the recording is copyright 2012 by the Orion Publishing Group, an Hachette UK company. For information about other Orion audiobooks, visit the website at www.orionbooks.co.uk.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.